in verses 8 through 16, the issue here has to do with Daniel's reaction to the fact that the king had appointed a daily ration from the king's choice food and the wine that he drank for the guys from Judah that were going to be trying to take part in his governmental structure, instruction that he had given to Ashpenaz. And that's an issue that we're going to talk about a little bit this evening, because it says that Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself, or the prince of the eunuchs, is I think the way the King James says. This whole thing about Daniel deciding that he would not defile himself with the king's food or wine was a big deal with the Jews. I suppose we see part of that when we read in the book of Acts how Peter was up on the roof and waiting for food and fell into a trance, I guess, and had a vision. And all these animals were let down on this sheet from heaven, and he was told to rise and eat, and he said, I have never eaten unclean food, and I'm not starting now. But he went ahead. I mean, you know, that whole thing indicates just how ingrained it was in Judaism to follow the dietary law. If you had any, well, it was just part of the culture, so it really didn't have a whole lot to do with what your attitude toward God was or anything. It's just something you observed because you were Jew. And it's, I think, for an American audience 2,000 years later, that it's indicative of an issue that Paul addressed when he wrote to the Corinthians, because he actually taught two different things in the New Testament about this food stuff. It says that Daniel made up his mind, is the way the New American Standard says it, but that's really not a translation of the words, because the King James has it when it says that he decided in his heart, he purposed in his heart. Because the whole issue there is that he's recording his own decision about what he would and wouldn't do, and it had, because he used the term, he said it in his heart, that it was a determination that had a kind of a level of intensity that more or less dominated every other consideration, because, as it turned out, it became a life or death issue, because the prince of the eunuchs wouldn't, he wouldn't do it. So the issue here on the focus of attention on the dietary issue, that he wouldn't eat the king's food and he wouldn't drink the king's wine, was what I've called an objectively marginal but subjectively critical issue, because in Paul's writings, on the one hand, he said that eating food that was offered to idol was insignificant because there's no such thing as another god, so food sacrificed to something that was supposed to be a god was being sacrificed to a non-entity, and therefore it was a no-brainer. I mean, you just didn't have to worry about it. And yet, in the first century, it was an issue, even at the first church council in Acts 15, when they came to grips with the gospel and the fact that you're not saved by your performance but by faith, and you didn't have to become a Jew if you were a Gentile and all of that. Nonetheless, in that letter, they told the Gentiles to abstain from eating food that had blood in it and stuff like that. So they were still back on this dietary stuff. And yet, on the other hand, Paul told the Corinthians that if they ate meat that was sacrificed to idols, it was sacrificed to demons, and they shouldn't do it because they were participating with the demons. And so you get this ambivalence because of the fixation that the Jews had on the food thing. And to me, that's interesting, because from what Paul said, the issue of eating was a marginal issue. I mean, God could not have made all meats clean, like it says in Mark, when Jesus said, it's not what goes in your mouth that defiles you, it's what comes out of your mouth. And so the whole issue there was that you couldn't defy yourself by the way you ate. And technically, that was true with this caveat. They had been told by God not to eat certain things. So if they did eat it, it was disobedience. It wasn't that the food defiled them, but it was the attitude that they were taking. And that's why I call it objectively marginal. Jesus was saying the truth when he says it's not what goes in your mouth that defiles you. But Paul also taught that if you couldn't do something by faith, it was sin. So if you've been taught all your life that you shouldn't play cards, or if you're a girl and you've been taught all your life that you couldn't wear makeup, if you bought that, it didn't really matter that God didn't care if you played cards or wore lipstick or not. He cared because you couldn't operate by faith and do those things because you were violating your conscience. So I really think that one of the issues here is that passage in Luke 19:17 where Jesus actually says that because you were faithful in a little thing, I'm going to give you a large responsibility. Because those that are faithful in little things will also be faithful in the larger things. And I think that people overlook that. They tend to think that if they're faithful in the big things, they can do anything they want to with the little things. I mean, you know, it's just like driving down the highway. The law says that you're supposed to drive under this particular amount of speed or at that level. And people don't pay any more attention to that than man the moon. Just drive however they want to drive unless there's a cop up there. And then the brake lights all come on. But that same person that will ignore those little things that they consider little things will hesitate when it comes to a big thing, especially Christian people. And we've got it all backwards. Because Jesus said, you need to be faithful in the little things so that then that faithfulness will carry over into the larger. But if you are not worried about those little things, then you'll probably be compromising on the larger ones too sooner or later. And this is one of the things that Daniel faced as a probably mid-teens, a young man, having been taught all this Jewish dietary stuff, and the king is appointing them to eat food that probably came off of sacrifices to idols. I mean, I don't know that everything that the king ate had been offered to an idol before he ate it. I don't have any idea if that's the case. But that would probably be the major objection that Daniel would have, that it had been meat sacrificed to idols. Or perhaps it just wasn't butchered properly, had blood in it. So he just made up his mind that he wasn't going to do it. That put a kind of point of conflict right there at the beginning before they ever even got into the program. And I think that this determination in his heart, there's a lot of people that really focus on being determined. You know, you can be anything you want to be if you just want to be bad enough. And we have a lot of people who think that the ability to live a certain way depends on the strength of your will and decision making. I don't see that in the scripture. I don't think that men's will. I think that any individual can make a firm decision in some areas of their lives and stick with it. But it'll be in those areas of their lives that are not really difficult. I mean, it's really easy for me to make a firm decision not to eat spinach. I don't have any problem with that at all. And I can be just as firm on that for year after year after year. It makes no... But it's not quite the same with ice cream. Anyway, point being, I think that one of the issues that we run into, especially with a guy like Daniel, and especially when we preach Daniel and stuff, that we make a big deal about how he made up his mind or he determined in his heart. And I've said this in the notes, that determination had no strength in itself. But it was rooted in faith in the promise of God that was made through Habakkuk. In other words, I believe that Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah understood Habakkuk's message, and they knew that they had been promised by God that they would live, because the just by faith shall live. And I think that given that, there was a lot of freedom in their ability to think perhaps outside the box when it came to the things they were facing, unless it got some real critical pressure, like in chapter 3, where they're faced point blankly with the demand that they bow down and worship Nebuchadnezzar's idol, and they just, well, that's a whole lot worse than eating his food. But they had squealers in the group. Oh, that's all the Jews, you know, they wanted to point them out to the king because they hated them, wanted them out of the way. And then the king says, are you going to do it or not? And they said, well, we're not. Well, that kind of determination has to have its roots in faith, because whenever it gets to be a life-threatening thing, a whole lot of decisions go by the wayside. If this is really going to cost me something serious, then I'm not going to do it. That kind of attitude. And for believers in our generation, we can make all kinds of commitments that are not going to cost us a whole lot. But boy, if it comes down to, if it's going to be a critical issue for us, it's going to cost us a significant amount, then we better have some kind of a promise from God that's at the root of whatever decisions we're making, because otherwise we won't be able to be consistent. But Daniel did. He made this decision, and it says in verse 8, he sought permission from the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. It's an interesting thing here, because he approached this guy. Ashpenaz was his name, but he never mentioned him by name again. He approached this guy, and this prince of the eunuchs is mentioned four times in this long paragraph from verse 8 to 16, with a request that he not have to eat the food and drink the wine. And then you have this verse 9. It says, now God granted Daniel, the word favor there is the Hebrew word chesed, and it means the loyal love. It's one of the key characteristics of God's covenant faithfulness to Israel. He is filled with loyal love toward those that he has entered into covenant with. And the word compassion is a word that's built off of the attitude of a mom carrying a baby in her womb for 9 months and then giving birth to it and having all these extremely strong motherly fixations on this baby. Now, not all women do that. I mean, because sin is distorted a lot of things, but nonetheless, it's the natural thing for a woman to have a strong feeling for her babies, the ones she carries in her womb for 9 months. It's that Mama Grizzly thing that came up in our political thing here several years ago. But it's that attitude of the motherly feeling that you're going to take care of this person, and that's the compassion word. And it says that God granted Daniel this loyal love and compassion in the sight of the prince of the eunuchs. And then it says, and the commander of the officials, same guy, it's a repetitious thing again, said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. So basically, he's got this tender feeling for Daniel, loyal love and compassion, but he ain't going to risk his life over it. And to me, that's kind of an oddity. Why would Daniel say that God had granted Daniel favor and compassion if it wasn't going to influence his decision? And this is where you get down to the nitty-gritty. He's saying, look, if I don't obey the king and he discovers it by looking at you and you look sickly and whatnot, he's going to want to know why you're not thriving, and if somebody has to tell him that I'm not giving him the food that he's commanded me to give you, then it'll be my life. And that tells us a couple of things about what's going on with Ashpenaz. One of them is he knows what it's like to serve in the court of a towering egomaniac. Nebuchadnezzar is such an ego-driven person that he cannot stand to have somebody contradict him or not obey him. That's what he flew into a rage over with the fiery furnace thing. There wasn't any need in heating that furnace up seven times hotter than it was supposed to be. But it was an expression of, you're going to do this or else. And Ashpenaz knew the king well enough to know that he would be in big trouble if he just flat outright didn't do what he was told to do. And he's not going to do it. In spite of the fact that he has these feelings for Daniel. But it's really kind of interesting then when you go on to verse 11. Because Daniel goes out from dealing with Ashpenaz and he goes to the overseer whom Ashpenaz had appointed over Daniel. And notice this, the commander of the officials in verse 8, commander of the officials in verse 9, or prince of the eunuchs in verse 10, prince of the eunuchs in verse 11. You get the impression that he's focusing on this guy's position before the king and Daniel's submission under him, because he has renamed them all. So he knows he's got to do whatever this guy says. But as soon as he gets a no from Ashpenaz, he goes to the overseer whom Ashpenaz has appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So he's not given up. He's made this decision. He knows it's probably a life or death decision, except that Habakkuk said, you're not going to die. So in that respect, he knows he's not going to be able to be put to death for it, but he doesn't know what it'll cost him. So he goes to the guy that's actually delivering the food every day. Given all of the responsibilities of the prince of the eunuchs, he probably had, put the responsibilities on several of his underlings and told them this. And so he had put an overseer or a steward over Daniel and his three friends. And he was responsible then for bringing their food to them. So Daniel turns to him and he says, please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. Now, the very fact that Daniel went to this guy indicates that verse 9 is true. Ashpenaz has some strong feelings of care, concern for Daniel and his friend. But he's not going to risk his life about it. But he's left the door open for Daniel to work the system so that as long as he's got his backside covered, he'll go along with it. As long as he can say, I told him to give him the food. But he goes to this steward, and his request is reasonable. On the one hand, how much damage can be done actually in 10 days? But on the other hand, how much benefit's going to happen in 10 days? So he says, let us be given, the King James says pulse, P-U-L-S-E, but it's translated vegetables here. The word actually means whatever grows from a plant. So this could be fruit and lettuce and tomatoes and, anything that you could grow from the ground. Let us have non-meat food for 10 days. And instead of drinking wine, just give us water. And then, since the problem in verse 10 is, the king will see your faces looking more haggard. Since that's the issue, what the king's going to see, Daniel basically takes an approach that, hey, if what the king doesn't see ain't going to hurt him. If he's going to judge us on the basis of the way we appear, give us this vegetarian diet for 10 days. And then you look at us and see if we look any worse than the young men who are eating the king's choice food. And then make your decision about how you're going to treat us according to what you see. So it's a reasonable request, and it's not a belligerent thing. Daniel has made up his mind. He's not going to eat this food. If he has to get belligerent, he may, but he doesn't have to at this point. He's just asking for a way to work around it. And apparently the steward that had been put over him liked the boys too. So he said he would test them for 10 days. And it's really interesting to me that, what do you think? You think when they sat down to eat their vegetarian diet that they just kind of ate a little bit and went on their way? I think they stuffed themselves every meal because they knew they had 10 days to make sure that they would look healthy. And that's not a lot of time, but it's apparently enough time. So they ate it. And so this guy, and King James calls him Melzar, and the New American Standard translates it the overseer whom the commander had appointed. And the reason for that is that the word sar, S-A-R, is the word that's translated commander. And Melzar is somebody who's under the commander. So it's probably not a proper name. It's probably not Melzar, as the King James says. It's probably a subordinate to the czar, the S-A-R, czar, the commander. So he agrees. Apparently, in his way of thinking, there's a buffer now between him and the king because he's not Ashpenaz. And as long as the issue is what the king sees, then let's just see what it looks like in 10 days. And then the young men stuffed themselves for 10 days on this vegetarian diet. And at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better. And they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. And I'm not sure that all of that was a result from the eating of the food. I think that God had a hand in making sure that these boys' decision would be supported by him. God has a way of doing that when we make a firm decision to do something that's pleasing in his eyes. Peter says he's given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness in this present evil age. So he had a hand in their health. And so it says in verse 16 that the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them the pulse, the vegetables. So this paragraph exists in the book of Daniel, I think, because it shows the foundation for the basic thesis of the book. We said when we were introducing it that the basic issue is God resists the proud, he gives grace to the humble. And that's particularly important in chapters 2 through 7, where the issues of the proud are dealt with as the Gentiles. But given the fact that Daniel has made a firm commitment in his own heart and mind to be faithful to God, then he can expect God to prosper his way, make it work where that'll work, especially given the promise that the Babylonians are not going to kill you. You know, normally we don't have that kind of a commitment from God. If he gives us instruction and we want to be faithful to it, we have to be willing to put our lives on the line. And if it kills us, it kills us. We have to be faithful regardless. Daniel wasn't in that shape because he knew he had promised from God that he wouldn't be killed. So that, I think, gave him the freedom to think outside the box and how can we make this work without offending the king and without getting Ashpenaz in trouble and all of that. So I believe that's really what's going on here, and it lays the foundation in for chapter 3, where the other three, not Daniel, but Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, have to deal with this determination that they're not going to bow to this idol. And I know everybody says, well, where was Daniel? Well, I don't know. But verses 8 through 16 raise, I think, a very important theological issue, and that is this whole thing about making decisions to be faithful to God or not. I believe that the strength of the human will is very minimal in terms of actually being able to accomplish anything really significant. And that's the reason why salvation is not by works. Because you can make all kinds of decisions that you're going to do or not do certain things, but they don't have the ability to bring that to pass. So a lot of times I think that that realization actually causes people to be reluctant to make firm decisions. But I think this text tells us, yeah, you've got to make the decisions. you don't need to think that it'll carry you, but you do need to believe that God will carry you if you make the decision. I've said it like this. I don't think that we can count on our will to enable us to do the will of God. But I don't think we'll end up doing the will of God if we don't make the decisions. If we don't determine in our hearts to be obedient here and whatever the situation is, and do it in light of whatever it's going to cost us. If we don't make those firm decisions, then they will not be carried out. If we make them and we're not depending on the Lord, they won't be carried out either. But it just seems to me that the scriptures are full of the fact that willpower is not the answer, but God doesn't empower us unless we are willing to make the decisions. So, you know, it's like I had a young man that I had opportunity to talk to, and we were talking about Romans 12:1-2, and present your body. He said, I'm not doing that. He's a Christian. I'm not doing that. There's no telling what he'll make me do. And that's a dangerous decision, but it's also driven by fear. There are lots. In fact, I had a young lady tell me very recently, I don't want to have to face some of the things that God might want to do to get me to be where I need to be in my Christian life. And I thought, oh man, that's not good. Well, yeah, but in the human way of thinking, we think we're going to escape trouble by staying a little bit, keeping some distance between us and the Lord. No, it isn't going to happen, because 1 Thessalonians 5 says, faithful is he who called you, who also will do it. And he'll do it whether you agree with him or not. He'll do it whether you cooperate with him or not. So I think that one of the big issues in verses 8 through 16 is the attitude that Daniel took. He knew what he would and wouldn't do. He knew what God had promised. But he also knew that there's room for thinking outside the box and not being belligerent, not forcing the issue before the king, but figuring out a way to where it might work. And sure enough, that attitude God blessed and gave Daniel the kind of freedom to... He gave them the loyal love and compassion of those that were over him so that they were willing to work with him on it. And as it turned out, he and his three friends were healthier than all the rest of them.